The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi everyone, I'm here with Louis Ress on episode 10 of Miami Memoirs. Louis is a lawyer who has very interesting stories to tell us, and they apply to what's going on in our everyday lives. He's definitely someone with a history, lots of experience. So what are you going to talk to us today about, Louis?
Today we're going to talk about travel. That's the name of this story in my book called Strange Cases and Wild Tales. And it goes back to coming to the South from the North. I was born in Brooklyn, and I went to Cornell, upstate New York, and the Cornell Law School. And then I was in the military, and I got out of the military in 1956, and I was going to practice. I had been admitted to the New York bar, and it was a military attorney down, and my military life is a whole separate subject. But now it was over, and I was heading down to Florida. So I said, what am I doing? How am I going to live in the South and Florida, and why go there? My father was struggling in his practice. He had a small practice in New York. And I looked around New York, and I didn't like what I saw. It was a very aggressive, materialistic world, a very hard, mean, tough. And I didn't like the way the practice was conducted, and I didn't like the way people lived. The quality of life was not a kind and gentle and loving and caring life. So I said, I'm going to move to the South. No more slush and sleet and snow and ice. And I had done a 360 in my car on the Belt Parkway. I said, that's enough of that. Mm-hmm. And then I spent 6 years in Ithaca, New York, skidding and sliding down the State Street on the ice. And I said, I'm out of here. So my dad was very instrumental in my life, too. I said, only in America there's opportunity. It's the land of opportunity. And it still is, but to a lesser degree, but it still is. So my father said, son, there are two ways of making a success in the practice of law. One way is to enjoy your education, but have fun. Join a fraternity, party, meet the daughter of a senior partner in a prestigious law firm, and marry her. The other way is to study very hard, be extremely competitive, be a leader. Get into an Ivy League law school. Be at the top of your class. Make law review. Get a job at the best law firm in town. Come in early. Work late. Grind it out on weekends and holidays. Write briefs that the supervising partner will take credit for. And after 3 years, marry the boss's daughter. That was my father's advice. And he really believed the truth in that joke. Mm-hmm. He had struggled. Of course, he came from a very limited background and almost poverty. And wound up making a decent living, mm-hmm. and was able to send his kids to college without any scholastic help. He made too much money for me to qualify for a scholarship, but not enough to be able to pay for it comfortably. So I had to work when I was in school, mm-hmm. which I did through law school and college. Anyhow, I literally believed that America was the land of opportunity. And in those days, it really was. And no matter where you came from, if you gave it your best and you were honest, good things would happen to you, and you would share in the American dream, and you could be a big success. And that's the way America was, and I was a true believer. Move to Florida. That's the place to go. It's the land of opportunity. There's southern hospitality, mint juleps, pecan pie, magnolia trees, sipping bourbon, gentlemanly manners, hold the door open for the ladies, men dressed in white suits. There was soft speech, the sort of a drawl, you know, southern accent. And fried catfish and hush puppies and warm nights with heavy moist air and the scent of gardenias. That was my concept of the South.
Sounds lovely.
Well, of course it wasn't true.
Right. It's very romanticized.
Yeah, exactly. It was romanticized. So my wife and I headed for Florida. And we didn't think we'd live in Miami. Anyhow, we had just been married, and we packed our gear, and I think 2 days after our marriage, we left for Florida. And my wife came from a very elegant socialite family, very affluent family, and they weren't happy about me.
Taking her
in
away.
In fact, the New York Times had in the society section, we just saw it recently, someone sent it to us, debutante from Fifth Avenue, married slob from Brooklyn. Mary's lieutenant from, they didn't even put my name in there. So it was hot as hell in June of 1956, and my wife and I had packed our few belongings, and we left New York and headed down south on US 1. And that's how you came, US 1. There was no I-95, all traffic lights all the way down. And we had our car, a 54 Chevy with no air conditioning, and it was well over 90 degrees every day, just like it is now in the summertime. You couldn't put your arm outside the open window while you were driving. It was that hot. It would broil. We pulled up at $9 a night roadside motels with neon signs where you park at the door of your room. And we ate burgers from burger stands. And that was our honeymoon. But we were on our own and we were optimistic. And we crossed the state line, the Florida state line, and we were talking about where to live. And we decided any place but Miami. Miami had a terrible reputation. It was the pits, terrible. So I started calling law firms around the state to whom I had written. And it was premature. They said, well, you got to take the Florida bar and it's coming up. And then we'll talk to you. I hadn't even taken a bar preparation course. I didn't know what Florida law was. I was just right out of the military. And I hadn't been to law school in 2 years. So I was pretty far behind in my preparation. But my resume looked good. I had Cornell Law School, admitted to the New York Bar, 2 years as a contracting officer in the Army Ordnance Corps, stationed on Wall Street, doing elite, top secret military contracting for highly sensitive anti-missile missiles.
I'm looking forward to the episode with that in it.
Yeah, well, we did. Well, we in Russia was the enemy at the time, and still is, I think. Mm-hmm. And we were worried about incoming. They had developed this multi-missile warhead where it would split open into like 100 little missiles, each one tipped with an atomic warhead.
Scary.
So now you had 100 atomic-tipped warheads coming in at you, and how do you defend the cities and the military bases from that sort of an attack? Mm-hmm. And so we had an anti-missile missile that was designed to counter mm-hmm. That type of an attack, and it's pretty secret. But in those days, I spent over $1 billion of the Army's money myself in 20 months. So
wow.
I figured there would no problem for me getting a job with a prestigious law firm. Boy, was I wrong. Was I wrong. Driving down the east coast of Florida, it became clear that there was little or no industry. And I, you know, here I'm a top Wall Street type attorney. There's no industry. The economy is sluggish, and it depended primarily on tourism. They had no need for Ivy League Yankee lawyers, you know. Miami was probably the only city with some life. It had some business buzz. There was a future potential, especially for trade with South America, and that was increasing in Miami. Still, there was little possibility for a job. Cornell Law School was the key to opening doors for a number of interviews with substantial Miami law firms. Blackwell, Walker & Gray, they're no longer in business. Schutz, Bowen, they're still in business. Nichols, Gaither, Green, they're out of business. They're gone. All their offices were similar. They were furnished in what I called early bank. Early bank was heavy drapes, thick carpets, dark mahogany furniture with brass lamps. The walls were lined with gold-framed oil paintings, portraits of the founding partners of the firm, and the lawyers all wore dark suits, white shirts, striped ties, black shoes, and had close-cropped haircuts with no facial hair, no mustaches, no sideburns, no beards. Mostly they had graduated from the University of Florida Law School and had attended Southern colleges, maybe going as far north as the Citadel. That's sort of a joke. That's a real Southern military school. That's the Southern West Point.
Citadel. Oh, okay.
They were all white, Southern Christian men, not one woman. And as a woman, you can appreciate
yes.
that in your early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
You can appreciate no women at all. And that's when Ruth Bader Ginsburg talks about what she went through.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I lived through that before she did. I was 2 years ahead of her. I knew her. And I was too, and I went to the dean and I said, why don't you have women in Cornell Law School? We only had two women in the whole school.
Wow.
We had 300 students.
Oh, my gosh.
We had 100 in each class average. And we had maybe two, three women. And he said, well, we have an obligation to society to turn out judges and people who become head of big corporations and people who go into big law firms and dominate the law practice. And women don't do that. They go home and have babies and keep house.
Boy,
and cook,
were they wrong.
And clean. And he says, we can't afford to turn out people like that. They can go to other schools and learn that. This is what his reasoning was.
Wow.
So and
sad.
And
I'm glad we've
degree,
come farther than that.
And he also said the man has to be the breadwinner for the household. And that's why men earn more than women. It's a long story.
Yeah.
I lived through it. And I was screaming and yelling about it then. So my mother was president of the League of Women Voters, so I was brought up as a pro-feminist.
Yeah, what they don't think about is if women earned just as much, the household would be better because you're having two high-income individuals, professionals. Everybody wins.
We'll get there. Anyhow, they had no Northerners, they had no Jews in these law firms, blacks, Hispanics. You're kidding. Forget it. There wasn't a black lawyer in Florida that was in a firm.
Of course not, at that time.
There were a couple of black lawyers. There were very few black lawyers. Very few. I was not accepted in that crowd. The nicer attorneys were frank with me. They'd come out and interviewing me, and they'd say, Lewis, we really like you, and you would fit right in. But one of the partners, you know, he won't have any Jews in the firm. And they were blatantly, openly anti-Semitic and racist. And anti-feminist.
You had to be white and you had to be Christian. And you had to be a man.
No, you had to be Protestant.
Protestant.
So there were a few Catholic firms. I wound up representing the Diocese of Miami. But there were some Catholic firms. But they were all Catholic, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't happy that I was representing the diocese either. Anyhow, almost all of the Jewish, they would tell me, look, Lewis, all the Jewish lawyers are over on Miami Beach. You know, you ought to look over there. And then another one would say, well, I think you would be happier in New York. Go back to New York.
Wow.
So here I am. The bar was approaching, and it was only given in Tallahassee.
Mm-hmm.
And it took 3 days of writing essays, 8 essays a day, 1 hour essays, 8 of them, 3 days. That's 24 essays.
Cool.
And we drove north on Route 27. That was the only way to get to Tallahassee from Miami.
Okeechobee.
Yeah, you go up through Okeechobee. You know it.
Yeah.
And there was nobody in Okeechobee in those days either. They were busy growing catfish in the lake. Anyhow, the air was so thick with humidity, you could cut it with a knife. And here's where it gets interesting. The Florida cities and the towns were very slow-moving places. They were built up around town squares with green lawns, large shade trees, benches, and almost always a large bronze or granite statue of a Confederate soldier. He would be standing, usually an ordinary soldier, or on horseback, often a general. He would be in the center of the square. The statue was almost always donated by the Daughters of the Confederacy, and it was often draped in Confederate flags. There was frequently a list of those who served and those who died in the cause of the Confederacy engraved into the base. Just across the street, there would be an old white-columned courthouse, and it would be raised up about 6 steps with a rusted fire escape on the side of the building. There were no malls. There were no chain restaurants. The locals chatted in the coffee shop just on the edge of the square with linoleum floors and a menu that featured catfish and hush puppies. You know what hush puppies are, Kat?
Mm-hmm.
Hush puppies are cornmeal that's rolled into a sphere and dropped into boiling fat with the crust on around it. And
Do they taste good?
To keep the dogs quiet. When you we want to shut up the dogs, you go, hush puppy.
Oh, I see.
So Orlando was a slow, sleepy place with red brick streets and one old hotel. And I think it was the Edgewater Hotel. Ocala had one restaurant. The restaurant was called the Silver Dollar. And all the black population in Orlando was confined to a ghetto. And it was a slum. And it still is. And it's still confined to the same ghetto in Ocala.
Yeah, we still see those signs of segregation.
Oh, yeah, it's economic now, and I'm going to tell you about it. I'm going to tell you that it still exists.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
You know, these stories, I wrote this story a long time ago before we had this issue about tearing down all the statues. So, but it became relevant, and I'll get into that, too. Because I usually had, you know, when I say there's a statue of a general on a horseback, that usually was General Robert E. Lee.
Mm-hmm.
He was the big hero of the South, Robert E. Lee. Then they had... Jefferson, not Thomas Jefferson, but Jefferson Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Stonewall Jackson and James Longtree, people you don't know about. But that's what I grew up down here with. And of course, they didn't have any statues of Lincoln or Grant or Sherman, God forbid. Sherman had the march, you know, burning everything down,
mm-hmm.
burnt down Richmond. And
I think he did a war of attrition, right? He was
it was a vindictive thing that he did, and he was against Southern life and the plantations, and he destroyed everything, and he damaged the economy terribly by doing it, and he made terrible enemies of the people in the South. And I'm not a defender of civil war in the South, but if your people come in, no matter how good or bad they are, if they start burning down your homes and your churches
Doesn't help
and your
anything.
Plantations, you don't like them.
Right.
No matter what the reason. Anyhow, you don't see any statues of Lyndon B. Johnson either. And I'll tell you about who he was, because nobody knows really. Few people, the people know, but they don't talk about it as much as they should. Anyhow, the further north we drove, the more southern the area became. Tallahassee was typical. There were the old two-story plantation homesteads for the rich and wooden shacks with outhouses for the poor. They were all in one area.
Those two options.
Right. The main activity was politics in Tallahassee, and it was mostly conducted at the Silver Slipper restaurant in private back rooms, which were thick with cigar smoke. The government clerks were all wearing white shirts, and they were all white people, and they moved in slow motion. The men wore red suspenders, and in addition, they wore belts, so they had to reassure that their pants wouldn't drop. But that was the thing. You wore a belt and a suspender, both. Everyone I spoke to had a deep, heavy Southern accent. Y'all, how you doing now? And it's so nice to see you up here. And one lady was really funny because she says, oh, you're from Miami. Well, welcome up South. And they were very friendly and helpful, though. My wife read out loud to me from a set of bar preparation notes, which was a gift from another New Yorker who never made it through. So I didn't know how good his notes were. But you had to know a lot of Southern law, Florida law. For example, did you know that miscegenation, which is a racially mixed marriage, was grounds for an annulment? One party only had to be 1/8 black, and that was the test, and you had no marriage. The marriage was null and void. Women could do little. I got your attention. Women could do very little without their husband's consent. Mm. They couldn't sign a contract. They couldn't own real estate. They couldn't sell real estate. They couldn't do anything. They were treated as the husband's personal property. Cattle had the right over cars, the right of way over cars on the streets. They did in Florida. You had to know those things. Any amount of a driver's contributory negligence, in other words, if he was in fault in any part to any degree, would bar him from recovery in an auto collision. You know, they have 1% at fault and you couldn't collect. They changed that, of course, later on to prorate it. Segregation was everywhere. Separate but equal was the law. But there was no such thing as equal. Separate? Yes, sir, you bet it was separate.
Yeah.
They had... the black people all lived in slums for the most part, in wooden slatted windows, shacks, ghettos. There was no running water.
Wow.
Galvanized metal tubs hung on the rear door. You know what a galvanized tub is, those big tubs?
Mm-hmm.
That was the Saturday night bath. They were filled up with water from heated in kettles, and they were used 3 or 4 times. And there was no inside plumbing. They used outhouses.
Mm-hmm.
The streets were muddy and unpaved. And that is downtown Miami, too. That existed in 1956, right downtown, and existed for a long time into the 70s. And in fact, Coconut Grove was pretty big on that.
Mm-hmm.
Blacks couldn't walk on the sidewalk if there were whites on it. They had to get into the gutter.
Oh,
they couldn't go into a white movie theater. They couldn't go into a restaurant or a hotel, much less stay there. And the schools were worse than those in third world countries. A lot of the teachers were illiterate. Mm-hmm. They were black teachers, but they never got educated. They couldn't teach. Mm-hmm. There were poll taxes. There were oral and written exams for voting rights. In the mornings, black men stood in knots on street corners looking for day labor jobs, and when a pickup truck stopped, they jumped in the back to get day labor. Mm-hmm. The Klan and the White Citizens Council organizations were everywhere. Education.
And the Klan, just to be clear, you're talking about the KKK, right?
Right, it was the KKK, and the change I'm going to tell you about it in a minute. I'm going to expound on this. Mm-hmm. Education, the key to breaking out, and still is, in my opinion, the key to breaking out, was closed to blacks. And today it's much more open, but it's still not an even playing field. It's a very tilted playing field.
Oh, yeah.
But the blacks were trapped. In those days, they were totally trapped.
Yeah, the system made it to make sure.
Met a number of black people that broke it and got out, but it was tough. It's not easy. Now, the bar exam was conducted in a room without air conditioning for those 3 days. My sweat was dripping down on the desk, and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote 8 essays a day. And at night, my wife couldn't understand why we went to the movies instead of studying. I told her that it was too late. We left Sarasota. We left down from Tallahassee to Sarasota, down Florida's west coast, and then around Lake Okeechobee on 2-lane roads, 1 lane in each direction. We went across from the lake, off the road down on Lake Okeechobee. There was a rundown wooden shack. It was a bar. And the bar had a huge sign on the roof, like a billboard. It was the size of the entire building, this billboard. It faced directly into the road, and it read, "No, N-O," from the top. It was about 15 feet high, those letters, "No." And then they had the N-word. Huh. Then they had kikes and spics underneath that. That was a little bar. That was my welcome to Florida.
Oh, my.
So that's my story. And now I have a lot to tell you about, okay?
Well, I have a quick question for you.
You have to
Would
lie
you,
down. You have
do you
ask.
Consider yourself a Southerner at this point?
That's a good question. I lived in the South for 65 years, so I'm a Southerner. Mm-hmm. But I'm a different kind of a Southerner. So there are all kinds of people. You can be religious and not be a zealot. You can be religious and not be intolerant. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think the South is changing.
Hopefully
one of the big
better,
things
yes.
that changed the South was an invention that nobody talks about. It's called air conditioning. At the old days, the lawyers could take a galvanized tub and put ice in it and put a fan on the other side, blow the fan over the ice to cool themselves.
Wow.
That's when I came down, air conditioning was coming in, and it changed the whole world down here.
Yeah, but, made it livable.
And my children were born here in Hialeah Hospital.
Oh, I was born there.
You were?
Yes.
Well, they were born when no one spoke Spanish in Hialeah. And they had the Hialeah racetrack.
Uh-huh.
And Henry
yes.
Mylander, the butcher, ran Hialeah.
Who's
and my
that?
Friend John Dupuy had white belt dairies there in Hialeah. And
can you briefly tell me just real quick, who was that, the butcher?
Henry Mylander yeah. was his name. He was the mayor
yes,
of Hialeah.
Mylander Park. Mm-hmm.
And he was a very small town politician, very much in control of the government of Hialeah. Anything you wanted, you had to go to Henry and go see him in the butcher shop.
Oh, okay, I see.
Buy a lot of steaks and stuff, and maybe he would help you.
Huh.
But
well, thanks for
it was
that.
It was a different world. So the South has changed. Let's start off. By telling you, we'll talk about the statues, but I think I'll start off by telling you about the KKK.
Yes.
Well, the KKK was started by a guy by the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest. And then he became, it's a white supremacist organization. And its purpose was to preserve white supremacy and to combat Jews. And it was a neo-fascistic organization. It believed in fascism, and it believed in genetic superiority of the white people, the white race, particularly Nordics.
Mm-hmm.
It wound up being adopted in Kellogg from Kellogg cereals.
Oh, really?
Eugenics was the word in those days. If you look it up, it's a whole interesting topic. I ought to write an article about eugenics.
Yeah, Hitler was big on that.
You know, well, it was the study. They were measuring convicts, murderers' heads and skulls to see if there was a certain physical type, a criminal type.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did studies about people that were retarded, people that were malformed or formed differently than we are, most people are, people that had genetic problems. And in those days, if you were gay or lesbian or something, that was also an abnormal condition that they thought you had to be extinguished because it was inferior to your race.
Yes.
So Hitler lumped them all together in Germany and put them all in concentration camps, including the gays and the Jews and the gypsies and the people who were deformed or crippled with shortened legs or club feet or something. Mm-hmm. He'd go after everybody who wasn't to Aryan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the KKK is pretty much about it. Well, when the South started to become liberalized by the Constitution, by people enforcing the law, and they changed it to the Commoner Party. And then after the Commoner Party, it became the White Patriot Party. You're talking about these are successors in 1980, maybe, 1985, something like that. And in Georgia, they became the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan or the Georgia Knights. And they have a big statue of John Brown Gordon, who was the head of the KKK. I don't know if it's still there, but it was in front of the Georgia State Capitol.
I hope not.
It was there. It was there. Then the White Patriot Party, and they wanted to equip and train paramilitary armed forces, which they're still doing now. You see them out there, these guys marching around with their guns and
with their
so on,
AKs
courtesy
and...
of the ability to purchase and maintain weapons under the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So then they turned to change it to the White Citizens Council. That was 1954. And then then they became the Council of Conservative Citizens in 1985. And
wow,
all these
look at that name change.
Yeah, and a lot of politicians today were members of the Council of Conservative Citizens. And they gave speeches there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, these people, how do they become successors? They get the records. They get the membership lists, the names and addresses and the amounts they donated and where they're employed. And so when you talk about stealing data on the computers, this is a good example of the importance of that data in organizations with the KKK's membership list. Remember, the KKK, I told you, marched down Pennsylvania Avenue in 1926. I mean, you're talking about, I think they had 26,000 marches in those days. That's a tremendous, everybody belonged to the Klan. It was the thing to do. Everyone had the white sheets and the hat, and it was to preserve society. Of course, in the South, it was a terrorist organization because they terrorized the black people.
Yeah, there were lynchings, and they orchestrated lynchings.
Even more than that, that's horrible. But the average person was terrorized. They come and burn a cross in front of your lawn. They didn't have to do anything. Boy, you shut up and behaved. Hmm. It was a way of controlling, keeping you from voting.
And so they still had this group, and it was somehow legal for them to meet and assemble, and because they started changing
right
their name.
Right of assembly, you know, is legal. And even the ACLU will tell you, let them march. Just make sure it's a cold day. No one comes out. But let them march. They have a right to march. Then they had the Federation for American Immigration Reform. You never heard of that. And that was another one. That was to avoid integration, particularly in the schools. And I want to tell you something about the schools. I intended to get into that. I don't know. We may run a little bit long because this is exciting.
This is a very
stuff.
Interesting topic, yes.
Well, you had Brown versus the Board of Education. So now, and you had, by the way, if you want to talk about statutes that should be put up, they ought to put up a statute to Lyndon Johnson, because he's the one that got the Civil Liberties Act passed, the Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
And he also signed two very important presidential decrees, number 11246 and 1464. You never heard of that. So
mm-mm.
Nobody has. So
how did those help?
They implemented the integration of the schools. What happened was, in 1964, well, I'll tell you a little bit about it. President John F. Kennedy was trying to get the Civil Rights Act passed, and he couldn't deal. He was they're all political. The presidents have to deal with Congress, and they have to trade favors and stuff, and maybe build a highway through somebody's state in order to get them to do something or put a defense plant there or something. So President Kennedy was trying to get this done, and he couldn't.
Hmm.
He could not succeed. And remember, at that time, the South was part of the Democratic Party.
Yes.
And the senators, the Southern Senator Smathers and Strom Thurmond and all those guys were Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just switching on when Kennedy was losing them, and he was afraid that he'd lose control of his party. So he couldn't get it through. They filibustered.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the filibuster? Now they've pretty much done away with it. But in those
so
days...
So for those that don't know what a filibuster is, what is it?
A filibuster is when someone gets up in the Senate and speaks without sitting down for like 10 days in a row.
And it's meant to pretty much stop...
It stops business.
Exactly.
It stops all the business in the country. And or a good chunk of it, that in the Senate. They don't have it in the House. They have closure in the House. So then you have to have so many votes to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
And this hatred goes on. It was used by the Southerners mostly to stop the integration.
Mm-hmm.
That was what they were concerned about, the white supremacy and integration. At any rate, Kennedy couldn't get it done. After he was assassinated, Johnson was wheeling and dealing. He was a real tough guy, and he could bat your head against the wall, but Kennedy too. And he threatened and cajoled and begged and borrowed and got the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964. But if you read the Civil Rights Act, it's vague. I've read it. And it doesn't have enforcement.
Right.
And it doesn't have examples. And it's just a general statement like, you know, life is
this.
Good.
Yeah.
It's general. So he implemented it with two, actually, I call them executive orders. And the first one, 11246, changed the focus of affirmative action from non-discrimination without regard to race to one that seeks results based on race. So that was affirmative action.
Hmm.
So if you know the source of affirmative action, it's Executive Order 11246. Now you know where that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And 10925 was Kennedy's order, which said treat people equally based on race, religion, and color.
So sad
sex
that he
and
had
national
to,
origin.
So sad he had to actually say that, you
he
know.
Did. Yeah, he did. That was Kennedy.
Have people be aware that that's, you know, that's the right thing.
So that was 1961 when John Kennedy issued an executive order. You didn't know that. Now we have a president that rules by executive order.
He puts one out.
Week.
Yeah,
couple
he loves
of
them.
Every week. So now Lyndon Johnson got involved. And things did change a lot as a result. But the Civil Rights Act came into, you know, it's supposed to stop it in voting and in schools and in employment and in public accommodations, that kind of stuff. Well, now, the bottom line, you know, recently, by the way, the Supreme Court ruled that they don't need to look at the schools anymore. They don't have to supervise the states. The states are complying with the law, which is the biggest And the present Chief Justice, who happens to be a pretty reasonable person, but he's a conservative. He signed it. It was his ruling.
Ugh.
And so that's when they stopped examining and policing the integration of the schools, public schools.
Hmm.
So now it's going crazy that we have private schools. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And you have a Secretary of Education who's a great believer in giving federal money to private schools. Why would you want to do that?
It doesn't make any sense.
The reason you do that is to affect discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tool. So now
it's
you're
perpetuating
sitting,
the
you're
problem.
Sitting right in the, near the town of North Miami,
mm-hmm.
in Florida. I challenge you to go down to me, 135th Street, we're at 120th Street, and go over to the high school and take a look on a high school day and see how many white faces you see. The school is 100% or 99% black.
Yeah, it's systematic. They've constructed
school.
The neighborhoods in a
that's
way
the public school.
Where that's, you know, there are black
right.
schools and then there's white schools. Well, and then sometimes in between you have some cultural mixing, but there's still segregation.
Right, and you go up to Norland High School, and it's the same way up in Norland.
Mm-hmm.
And you go through the United States, and it's the same way. And they do it gerrymandering
mm-hmm.
Based on black areas where black people are socioeconomically restricted and restrained, and we have it today.
Yes.
And they talk about Black Lives Matter and the police. They ought to also say that every part of the community, of the residential community, should be integrated. Mm-hmm. And the federal government should come in and help in that
yes.
regard. They should say, if you don't have so many mixture in your community, you're violating the feeling in the country of assimilation.
Yeah.
You're never going to have assimilation if you don't do those things. And you're never going to have equality. Anyhow, I didn't even get into the statues that are being pulled down. So I told you a little bit about Lyndon Johnson. You don't see any statues to Lyndon Johnson. Of course, he was a great womanizer. So people, if they ever talked about him. So let's talk about some of the people that are untalked about that you haven't heard about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to give you some information that may shock you.
Let's hear it.
You know New York, the center of advertising is on one street in New York. Do you know the name of the street? Madison Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what was it named after? Madison. Who was Madison? James Madison. Who was James Madison? He was President of the United States. He was a colleague of Jefferson's. Madison had a plantation, maybe 2 hours ride by horse from Jefferson's plantation.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson, a gorgeous place. Madison's house was very nice. I've been there, but not quite as big. Okay, how many slaves on Madison's plantation? 104.
Wow.
I checked. Maybe 110. He had over 100 slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Madison. Is anyone tearing down a statue? Where's Black Lives Matter? I don't see them going
after Madison.
They're
changing the name on
Where
Madison
did
Avenue.
Did they yelling, take up James Madison High School? There's a Madison College. James Madison College, I think. They didn't make them change. Where's
this
Madison?
Whole, yeah, this
He's
whole
getting
country.
Away with murder. What about his statue?
It's embedded in our history.
So what you're going to find out is that if you do enough checking, you're going to find out somewhere along the line, many, many people who are venerated today did things that they would never do today, that they're shameful. They
mm-hmm.
didn't realize how offensive it was when they did it.
Mm-hmm.
If it was totally accepted. And I started to tell you about famous Southern people. I told you about Lee, right? And I'll tell you a little more about some of these statues. How many statues do you think they have in the state of Florida? Do you know?
Nope.
Okay, I counted 63. How many do you think in North Carolina?
Oh, 100 something?
140.
Yeah.
Including Chapel Hill, where they have Silent Sam. It's a statue in Chapel Hill University. And North Carolina is a pretty heavy Southern discriminatory state. What about Georgia? How many statues do you think they have in Georgia?
Close to 200, I'm sure.
201.
Oh.
You're pretty close. That's pretty good. So who are these statues of, and what do you do with them when you tear them down?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be where I'm heading in this discussion. You don't see, by the way, statues of great people, liberals, people who liberal in the sense, in the beautiful sense, not in political sense,
mm-hmm.
Like liberty,
mm-hmm.
liberty, justice for all, liberals in that sort of sense. You don't see them around very much. You can see Franklin Roosevelt. Where's a statue to Eleanor Roosevelt?
Yeah.
Well, Black Lives Matter should be putting up statues. When they take them down, they should put up one.
Replace them.
Everyone you put down, put up one. No, you never heard that before.
Yeah, it's a good strategy.
It.
Replace it with someone who's actually done something good for history.
Right. What about Eleanor Roosevelt? Well, Eleanor Roosevelt begged her husband to stop separating the armed forces in World War II by race.
Hmm.
And all the many of the Afro-American people were digging ditches and doing manual work in World War II in battalions, work battalions, they called them. And that was not nice. There was a few that were pilots, the Tuskegee group and so on,
yes.
airmen. But most of them were doing very menial work, and it was terrible. And then when they were into combat, they fought hard and they never were recognized. They never got the medals. White battalion in combat would get 1,000 medals
mm-hmm.
for bravery,
mm-hmm.
and a black battalion would get 10, and they were just as brave, if not braver.
Yes.
So you have Eleanor Roosevelt, who, you know, she was involved in human rights and freedom of speech and so on. Well, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, the St. Louis story about the ship that came with the Jews on it that he sent away back to Germany, and half of them went to concentration camps and died.
Oh, my gosh.
That ship was right in Florida, Miami, and they wouldn't let him in.
Oh, that's
They went to Cuba, they wouldn't let him in. It's called the St. Louis. And these people had visas. They paid for visas to go to Cuba. They wouldn't let them into Cuba.
That's devastating.
And then Roosevelt, because of the political pressure from people like Father Coughlin, you know, you don't know who they were.
Mm-mm.
These were white supremacists at the time. They were mean people. Bilbo, Senator Bilbo from the South. These are tough people.
And it's just to me, just it's so ironic because this country was founded on immigration and sort of, you know, promised land, really, you know, a new land where you could be free, where you can, you know, exercise whatever religion you are. And then yet it's something that's just embedded. We just can't get away from it in our history.
If you dig deep enough, you'll see that the dirty picture of economics creeps in.
Yes, it's all about money,
well,
power.
We had a country that we needed people to help develop. We needed people to dig the canals. We were digging a lot of canals in those days, like the Erie Canal and so on. We had a lot of railroads going through. There was big development for the railroads. They need people to dig the railroads, to put on the, dig the holes through the granite. And that's where they got Chinese labor. They had Italian labor. And they kept the labor pretty segregated, too. You find that the Italian development, particularly in the Boston area in Massachusetts, a lot of Italians in Massachusetts, they came pretty much at once to do particular jobs. They brought them into, and they advertised, come over here and dig this railroad or do this and this project, build a bridge or whatever they were doing. So the country was developing and they needed labor and they needed, they had a lot of land. And they didn't have people to farm it.
Yeah, it was built by immigrants, and in many ways still is.
Then, when they didn't need them anymore, when there was enough when you to sustain, we had enough activity going that we didn't require labor, cheap labor, we stopped doing it. When we need cheap labor, now we bring it in. We bring in agricultural workers.
Agriculture,
we welcome
them.
The torch is open to them.
Getting paid
but people feel
bare
this,
minimum.
They feel that they're getting inexpensive labor to displace them. Displace themselves. And the Afro-American people in particular are vulnerable because they hold jobs and they don't want to hold those jobs that are low on the economic totem pole. And then people come in and supplant them and they have no place to go.
Right.
So it's not a simple problem, although it's upsetting. And I was going to tell you about some of the Southern heroes that they pull down. So you know about Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee was a gentleman, and he, did you know they all these Southern generals, well, most of them had one thing in common?
They had
in
slaves.
Their education.
Oh, okay.
And I'll help you in education. What do they have in common in education? I'll answer you. You'll never guess. They all went to West Point.
Okay.
Every one of them. Robert E. Lee was a graduate of West Point. Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy, he went to West Point. James Longstreet from South Carolina. General Longstreet, he went to West Point. Jeb Stuart, which is J-E-B, it's not Jeb, his name is not Jeb, it's J-E-B Stuart. Jeb Stuart went to West Point. A.P. Hill, I don't know if you ever heard of him, he went to West Point. These are the great generals of the South. They all went to West Point. They all knew one another. They knew Grant. When Grant was at West Point, Longstreet, I think it was Jeb Stuart maybe, was his roommate, a classmate. They were friends. And afterwards, after the Civil War, when Grant ran for president, they backed him, and they became Republicans. So
he had his posse with him.
Yeah, but all these people, now a lot of them were against segregation.
Really?
Yeah, almost all of these generals that I mentioned, every single one was against segregation, against and against secession. They didn't want to secede from the Union. They were against it.
Then how does that explain them being in such positions of power?
It was politics. The only one in the group that was bad was Jefferson Davis, who he was a real, he had over 100 slaves. He was a, he was born in Kentucky, but he was a senator in Mississippi. Mississippi is a separate place in the whole world. And he was the president of the Confederate States. And, of course, the capital was in Richmond. But he argued originally against secession. Jefferson Davis.
Most likely, probably economic reasons.
So
he was
smart.
Afraid of
the whole system
being independent.
The plantation system involved slavery. Even the cotton gin created the need for more slaves and more labor. And they didn't have the labor, and the, it was a labor heavy, labor active economy. And the slaves were considered, and it was just part of, look, this didn't just happen in the United States. I'm not a defender of slavery.
It's been throughout history.
All the black
Egypt,
people today that are screaming and yelling about slavery in the United States should go back to Africa and find out what happened in Africa with regard to slavery within the African countries mm-hmm. themselves. You don't hear that. Mm-hmm. That is not politically correct to talk about.
There was slavery
but
as well in
Africa.
There's
an obligation to be historically accurate. Mm-hmm. A lot of the slaves that were shipped over were captured by one tribe. Now you have the Hutu and the Tutsis, and they're mm-hmm. killing each other. But there were lots of tribes, and they would capture a village. They would take the women in and incorporate the women into their tribe, and the men were put into slavery. Mm-hmm. And they were either used as warriors in the front, or they were sold, shipped to the port and sold to white traders. Mm-hmm. So it was not a purely white crime. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of black people involved in that crime.
Yeah, the tribal mentality. So they would preserve their tribe, and if there was another tribe that was against them, they would, you know, capture and sell.
And very often their neighbors are fighting over land, mm-hmm. and it was very hostile. At any rate, these are the statues that we're tearing down, these guys. And if you look at them, they're, take it, for example, Robert E. Lee. Mm-hmm. Robert E. Lee was asked to be the general of the forces of the North by Abraham Lincoln before he became head of the South, the chief general for the South. They offered him the North. He says, I can't do that. I come from Virginia. Hmm. I can't go after my brothers and cousins and mm-hmm. sisters, whatever, and create a war against fight a war against my own people. So then they solicited him to become head of the army in the South. When he surrendered, they treated him, I think it was rescinded to Grant. He was allowed to ride his white horse that had a special name. I forget the name of his horse. Like Champion or something, mm-hmm. like Roy Rogers. And he rode his horse, and he had his sword, and they made a beautiful ceremony, and they treated him, they saluted him. Mm-hmm. These were guys killing each other and maiming each other a few days in the trenches. They would have given a price for Robert E. Lee's head if they had cut it off. And now they treated him as a gentleman. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't know what to do with him after the war. Did you know that? What did they do with Robert E. Lee?
He came from the North, but now he's in the South, and he's fighting for the South.
And a gentleman. He's not a mean guy. He's an extraordinarily refined person with great integrity. What do you do with him? So they wanted to put him in prison, you know. They were going to execute him. Mm-hmm. You can't execute him. They're going to put him in prison. This is not the Nazi war crimes. He didn't go out and kill people by virtue of their race. He didn't do that. Hmm. He was fighting for a lifestyle, which was the plantation lifestyle, which was this labor thing, which was slavery, which is terrible. But that's what it was, part of what his beliefs were. Mm-hmm. So they put him in prison for a while. It didn't work out. It wasn't nice. So then they put him in confinement in his house, which they do today, you know, house confinement, home confinement. Mm-hmm. That didn't work out either. Wasn't nice. So they got him a job. No, I mean, you know, people were complaining. He was writing his memoirs. He didn't have any money.
Oh.
So they didn't know what to do with him.
Okay.
So they made him president of Washington University.
Huh.
That was a school, Washington University. Never heard of it? Mm. Well, now it's called Washington and Lee. Mm. And it's a big college, university. So you want to take Lee's name off there? He died relatively poor. He was loved at the school where he taught. He was a very fine person, and he was very quiet. And you take some of these other guys were similar. I think I'm trying to think of who it was. Jackson, maybe it was. Stonewall Jackson. He was a professor of physics before.
Physics.
You know what Stonewall Jackson is? Where they fought up to this wall, and mm-hmm. they stonewalled. They wouldn't let the troops go past this wall, so mm-hmm. they called him Stonewall Jackson. And now they say he's stonewalling it.
Mm-hmm.
When you won't, give in or compromise. Well, he was second in command in the Civil War. He came from Virginia, but he was very quiet. And he liked to read poetry. He liked Shakespeare. These guys were human beings. Hmm. You know, this was not like the Nazis where they had lampshades made out of human skin. These were decent people. Anyhow, that's what happened. So now we're pulling down the statues. So what do you do with the statues?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, you know, Uncle Lewis has answers for everything. I didn't even tell you about the Dred Scott decision and Roger Taney. So there are statues of Roger Taney.
Tell me about this guy, because you mentioned him in episode 9. So tell me about
him. He was Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court and during the Civil War. I think it was like 1857, he handled the Dred Scott case. This Dred Scott was a slave who was living in a free state. I think he was in Pennsylvania or something. And He said, "You can't send me back to my master because I'm free. I married a woman up here. Mm-hmm. She's a former slave, and I'm not going back." And the case, they didn't know what to do with him. So they said, "Well, you got to go back." He said, "No, he went to court." And he took it all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And Justice Taney, Roger Taney, who came from Maryland, wrote the opinion. And he said, "This is not an issue of freedom. This is an issue of property rights."
Oh, gosh.
And Congress could not prohibit slavery. And he belonged to somebody else. He was the property of somebody else. And therefore, he had to be returned to his rightful owner.
Oh, no.
And that's the Dred Scott decision.
So he was taken from Pennsylvania.
And also, Taney wrote, it's called dicta. When you throw in something that's not necessary for the decision, you can make the decision, but they throw it in to set down rules, the law, precedent. And he said, slaves could never become citizens.
Wow.
So this is the part, nobody likes to talk about the United States Supreme Court being racist. Well, maybe we should tear down the gosh darn the Supreme Court, burn it because of this decision and others.
Yes.
So maybe they're tainted.
It's everything. Everything in this
tainted,
country has.
That means we should destroy it.
Has some connection to racism, inequality.
Right. So what am I getting to? I'm getting to something. I had so much more in this, but I'm getting to something. It's right to take down the statutes, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you venerate and respect something that is symbolic of the most terrible behavior you could contrive of and the most horrid beliefs that you could think of, it's a mistake to venerate it and respect it. Put it on a pedestal.
Yes,
and that's
much.
What they do. They're literally on a pedestal.
To be
and
remembered,
that's the expression.
To be glorified.
He put his wife on a pedestal. Well, you can't. You got to take them off the pedestal. And that's right. But I don't think you have to burn them, drown them, throw them in the river because they're part of history. And then if you don't do that, we forget. So you want to preserve
that's
them just
true.
To remind yourself, like the Holocaust, they show pictures.
Yes.
Because they say never forget.
Yes.
And I don't think we should forget.
No.
So this is something. We could do museums.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the biggest city that has this problem is Richmond, Virginia, probably. Of all, they have a whole road, whole big highway, you know, center in the city full of these statues.
Mm-hmm.
Taney has two statues that I could find. One of them was in Annapolis, which is not Annapolis, the institution for the Navy. Annapolis is a town. It's the capital of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a statue of him in Maryland. And then I think I found another one someplace else. And I could see taking those down.
Yes.
Take them all down.
Take them down, please.
And, right. But you could find a museum for them. Not a garden park where you come and walk through the garden and respect them, but a museum where you store them.
Yes.
And you can say in a separate hall and say, these are the people who were involved
these
in the Confederacy.
These are the people responsible for
here's what they did and here's what they
racism.
Were. Right.
Right. Prejudice.
And then you could replace them with, what about Harry S. Truman? Well, do you know much about Harry S. Truman other than that he authorized the atomic bomb? Well,
that's about it, yeah.
Harry S. Truman integrated the United States Armed Forces.
Hmm.
He's the one that did it.
So it wasn't FDR?
No, FDR wouldn't do it.
Eleanor begged him.
She begged him like crazy. She should get a statue. She should. She stood up for the underdog. For the union worker, for the guy that was exploited, for the gay community, too. I don't know if you knew that. A lot of her friends were lesbians and gays.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived down, she had an apartment in Greenwich Village, too, that nobody knows about. But she was a wonderful, wonderful humanitarian. Even Franklin Roosevelt, I don't know, he made a speech, it was famous, about the four freedoms, but you don't know what they are.
Mm-mm.
It was a very famous speech, and they had pictures, I think Rockwell, Norman Rockwell designed posters for the four freedoms. So freedom of speech, freedom of religion, that you could practice any religion you want, but not where you exclude other religions.
Yes.
Freedom from fear.
Wow, that's a big one. That's a big one we need to work on.
And here's one that'll shock you. Freedom from want.
Wow.
And we'll end with freedom from want, because now we're looking at the government helping people in time of a pandemic, and they have want, they have needs.
Yes.
And people are afraid that they won't be motivated to go back to work if you give them money. And in the meantime, they're starving.
Yes.
So you have Part of the four freedoms is freedom from want, freedom that you don't have to be thrown out of your apartment if you can't pay the rent,
mm-hmm.
and the government doesn't come in and say, we understand what it is to be a landlord, property rights
mm-hmm.
versus the tenants, individual rights. It's always been a fight between property rights, which the courts have protected,
mm-hmm.
and individual rights, which they've submerged under or treated less
mm-hmm.
Fully than property rights. So it wouldn't be terrible to help people and let them pay it back in one way or another, public service and
mm-hmm.
so on. So that's how we end this marathon discussion.
Sounds good. Yeah. Wow. It's very powerful stuff. Thank you, Lewis. Thank you so much. I look forward to our next one.